constipated. New York, London, Paris, Munich, everybody talk about
reaching up with Don Fess. Don Fess.
This is Don Fess, and we're reaching up again right now. All together in 204 countries with great in-person guests and music.
Hi, this is William Paul Young, author of The Shack, with Don on Reaching Up on the Celebrate Radio Network.
William Paul Young, author of the New York Times bestseller The Shack, which has sold over 15 million copies, joins me today. But first, some of the introduction from the audiobook of The Shack.
Who wouldn't be skeptical when a man claims to have spent an entire weekend with God? In a shack, no less. And this was The Shack. I've known Mac for a bit more than 20 years, since the day we both showed up at a neighbor's house to help him bale a field of hay to put up for his couple of cows. Since then, he and I have been, as the kids say these days, hanging out, sharing a coffee, or for me, a chai tea, extra hot with soy. Our conversations bring a deep sort of pleasure, always sprinkled with lots of laughs and, once in a while, a tear or two. Frankly, the older we get, the more we hang out, if you know what I mean. His full name is Mackenzie Allen Phillips, although most people call him Allen. It's a family tradition. The men all have the same first name, but are commonly known by their middle names, presumably to avoid the ostentation of first, second, and third, or a junior and senior. It works well for identifying telemarketers, too, especially the ones who call as if they were your best friend. So he and his grandfather, father, and now his oldest son all have the same given name of Mackenzie, but are commonly referred to by their middle names. Only Nan, his wife, and close friends call him Mac, although I have heard a few total strangers yell, "Hey, Mac, where'd you learn to drive?" Mac was born somewhere in the Midwest, farm boy in an Irish-American family committed to calloused hands and rigorous rules. Although externally religious, his overly strict church elder father was a closet drinker, especially when the rain didn't come or came too early, and most of the times in between. Mac never talks much about him, but when he does, his face loses emotion like a tide going out, leaving dark and lifeless eyes. From the few stories Mac has told me, I know his daddy was not a fall-asleep, happy kind of alcoholic, but a vicious, mean, beat-your-wife-and-then-ask-God-for-forgiveness drunk. It all came to a head when 13-year-old Mackenzie reluctantly bared his soul to a church leader during a youth revival. Overtaken by the conviction of the moment, Mac confessed in tears that he hadn't done anything to help his mama as he witnessed, on more than one occasion, his drunken dad beat her unconscious. What Mac failed to consider was that his confessor worked and churched with his father, and by the time he got home, his daddy was waiting for him on the front porch with his mama and sisters conspicuously absent.
We are at Capital Christian Center in Sacramento, California, with Paul, the author of a very big book called The Shack.
It's actually a kind of a little book. You
know? Well, it's had a big effect, and it made the New York Times bestseller list, and it's sold everywhere, and people love it, but there's also some controversy about it as well, which we'll get into. Tell us about your background and how The Shack came about.
My background is I'm Canadian-born, grew up in the highlands of New Guinea, missionary kid. Preacher's kid, bad combination. And then worked at all kinds of jobs, married a woman out of North Dakota, Minnesota. We settled in Oregon and have six children. My youngest is 17, my oldest is 30. And I've written gifts for friends and family for a lot of years. And Kim, my wife, had been after me to just put in one place how I think as a gift for the kids. And that's all I was trying to do in 2005 was get it done for Christmas. Got it done, made 15 copies at Office Depot, went back to work. Never have published anything, never thought about publishing anything, and my friends kept giving it away. It ended up in the hands of some folks who thought it could be a film. That started an actual publishing conversation, and 26 publishers turned it down, so a couple guys created a publishing company just to do it. We pooled our resources, limited as they were, and set up a website. And from and
did,
that website,
did I hear you say this morning that you printed up something like 15 books?
Yeah, I did, at Office Depot. And 15 copies was my my whole dream, you know. It was I've never quite written anything of this size. I've just written poetry and short stories and songs, and so 15 copies, that's six to my kids. Kim got a copy and the rest went to my friends.
Aside from your personal walk of faith, had you done anything spiritually before either?
Oh yeah, you know, I'm a missionary kid, preacher's kid, so I've done all kinds of things, whether it's been working in the Philippines or I was on staff at a church for a couple of years in the late 70s, early 80s. But I've done a lot of teaching in colleges and church places, just independent stuff. So I was involved in that. But most of my life was in business of one sort or another.
And you don't mind telling people what you told me just before we started, that for a little while you were a rock disc jockey in Saskatchewan?
Rock and roll, 6 to midnight. That's how I paid my way through Bible school, which is kind of an oxymoron, but...
So the 15 books, how did the 15 books get to be the first million books?
When my friends kept giving it away, and we ended up, they ended up creating that little publishing company out of California, we set up the website. The first thing that happened was a podcast that really generated things, and that was two guys talking about relationship with God. And because of that podcast that went all over the world, 45 minutes a week, they started talking about the concepts that were in the book before it actually got published. And we pre-sold 1,000 copies, and they went all over the world. And the rest of the, oh, we gave a whole bunch away, and then people started coming to the website, and they started buying 5, and then 10, and then 20, and then cases. Very unexpectedly, we were hoping to get through 10,000 copies in 2 years, which we've heard is quite aggressive. And we ended up going through actually 11,000 copies in the first 3.5 months. So we ordered 20,000, went through those in 60 days, ordered 30,000, went through those in 30 days. And it just took off. That's when Barnes & Noble, Amazon, and these kind of folks found us. They started coming to us. And in the first 13 months, we spent less than $300 in marketing and advertising and shipped over 1 million books. Out of a garage in Los Angeles.
I think the big publishers wouldn't mind doing that.
No, you know, the 26 publishers who turned us down, a number of them came back and visited us shortly thereafter. So they were quite surprised, as was everybody, including me. There's nobody more surprised about all this than I am.
Paul, tell us what The Shack, besides being a title of a book, is. What is The Shack?
Well, you can read the book as a story, and it's a fiction story. It's a mystery suspense wrapped up in a what if. You know, what if in the midst of our tragedies or great sadnesses, there is a God who is good all the time? And The Shack becomes a metaphor for the house on the inside. It's the house that people help you build. And a lot of us, we didn't get good help. And so it is a shack. It's not a nice a little house. It's got broken boards, as the walls aren't properly aligned.
There's no white picket fence?
No, it's just a mess. And so it becomes the place where we then store our addictions and we hide all of our secrets. And it's a place of shame, pain. And we don't want anybody to go in there. And so for some of us, especially religious kids, we then become performers, trying to paint a facade to people's expectations as a way of not letting them in the shack. And everybody has to go back. You know, at some point you have to go back to the places where you're stuck. And that means dealing with secrets and dealing with, you know, the addictions
and the facade.
Yeah, the facade, you know, you set up outside the shack, quarter-inch piece of plywood. You can paint as fast as you can pick up people's expectations. And the thing about the facade is that, you know, so much of religion teaches you a dualism. That is, you have your spiritual part of your life and you have the rest of your life. And that actually perpetrates this idea of the facade. And it's not like the facade is what you're trying to do to be duplicitous. You're not trying to be dishonest. You're trying to be authentic, but you're putting all your energy into the facade, hoping that one day maybe it will become the real boy. You know, and so it's all about, especially if you're religious, it's about praying a lot and reading scriptures and studying things and giving and involvement and all those kinds of things. And the facade becomes your hope. And that's But, you know, the addictions are still going on in the shack. The secrets are still there, and you're not authentic. So in the name of righteousness or religious performance, you're actually moving further away from authenticity.
In the shack, I believe God does not have a white beard.
Oh, yes. And this is the place where the main character, Mackenzie, has to go because it's the center of his pain. And he goes there first and just is furious, as any human being would be. And he thinks that Plato's God is the one who he believes in. And he thinks God is Gandalf with an attitude and, you know, the big grandfatherly omnibeing watching from a distant heaven with a disapproving heart. And that God doesn't show up. And he's just furious. And it's about, at that point, he basically gives up. And that's when a transformation takes place. He is then confronted with a God who is three persons, but the God the Father is actually a large black African American woman. And that has bent some people around the corner a little bit. But I was trying, in writing this for my kids, I was trying to get away from this Western, distant, unapproachable, unreachable, untouchable, unemotional God who really is looking for a reason why he can X you out of the universe. You know, it's not much different than Zeus. And there's nothing that portrayed that better to me than a large black African-American woman.
This was actually somebody you knew?
In part, yeah, Renee Greenwich. And I sort of built a persona off of her. And she passed away a few months ago, and I've known her for 30 few years. Beautiful, wonderful friend, and a large black African-American woman.
Reaching Up with Don Fess. Don Fess.
There's a lot of hurting in this society, in this world, maybe even some in you. But the surest way to change things is to be a blessing. Who can you help? Be a friend to. Show some love to. Be the change you want to see. Be a blessing to someone today and every day. This message from Street Cats, One Heart for Kids, and Celebrate Radio.
We will choose to be a blessing for life.
The Shack is one of the top 70 best-selling books of all time. Why? Because it's brought deep forgiveness and amazing hope to millions of people. The stories of what God has done through this book are truly astounding. Maybe you've had a shack moment. Now, we're taking the shack experience live through an awe-inspiring synthesis of music, performance art, aerials, dance, interviews, and thoughts from author William Paul Young, and songs from one of American Idol's most popular stars, Danny Gokey. It will be one of the most awe-inspiring shows you'll ever see. Join us on May 8th at 7 p.m. at Seattle's WAMU Theater and make it a Mother's Day your mom will remember forever. Stories from the Shack, presented by Promark Financial. For more info and to buy your tickets, go to storiesfromtheshack.com. Storiesfromtheshack.com.
So obviously a lot of people have loved your book and told other people about it, and then they've bought it and read it. And then you've had all the naysayers as well. Tell us a little bit about the positive and the negative reactions.
Yeah, you know, and it's overwhelmingly positive. You know, the negative side of it is a pretty small percentage, and it comes from, you know, folks that would rather be right than love, you know, for the most part. It's not that there can't be a conversation about the content of the book, and I think the controversy is a good thing. The positive side, I've got, you know, 110,000 emails already from all over the world, people who are telling me how the book has opened up the possibility of a relationship with God, people who've been hurt by religion, people who've had great sadnesses in their life, people who are just looking for something that is authentic. And the book has given them a language to have a conversation about the things that matter. And what's surprising is that I've gotten emails from psychiatrists and psychologists and 12-step programs and pastoral care and spiritual formations and people who help people. Those people only care if something works. You know, in theology, you can, you know, have an idea for 1,000 years. Doesn't matter if it actually works or not. You know, it's just a matter of you get to talk about it. But the people in the helping community, not one negative criticism. It just comes from the more theologically minded folks. And even then, it's not a lot of them. It's a very small percentage.
So the people who have an objection to what you wrote mm-hmm. are people, I gather, who don't like the fact that God may be somewhat like a big black woman.
In terms of character. You know, I think most of those people, and this has been my experience so far, most of those people have not read the book. They've just heard about it. And they form their opinions, and then they, you know, they're afraid. I think religion teaches you to be afraid. You know, you could lose your salvation if the three-legged stool you're sitting on has a leg kicked out from underneath it. And so you hold on with great tenacity. And these folks, they're not trying to, I don't think they're trying to be contrary. It's just part of the paradigm that they're a part of. And some of them are trying to defend God in kind of, you know, as a good, a positive spin as you can put on it. But that's okay. That's the conversation that really matters. And it's the conversation that then leads to a deeper understanding of what really matters, both to me as a human being and to the person that I'm in a conversation with.
But apparently you're separating, clearly, religion, quote-unquote, from faith.
Oh, absolutely separating it. And you can use religion in a positive sense, a generic sense. It's the old way that people talked about faith, even. And faith and religion tended to be the same thing. And I'm using it in a very distinct way. Religion is a system of belief in which there is a God something you're trying to reach for, nirvana or whatever, and you have to perform certain rituals and keep certain rules and obey certain things in order to get there. And I'm saying religion is destructive. And that's commonly understood. You can just look at history and you know religion's destructive. And faith is relational. Religion is performance. Faith is an expectancy about person and about a relationship with a God. But religion's, you know, you got to keep these rules, you got to do these rules. Religion's really about us and how good we are at keeping whatever the rules are. So it doesn't matter who the God is, not really.
And faith is the relationship.
Faith is the relationship, and it matters totally who the God is, because you're not going to trust. In this world where most of us don't trust anybody, you're not going to trust a God that you don't believe his character is good.
All this has happened out of 15 books being printed up. How have you, if you have, changed at all through the experience of the Shack becoming so successful, and how might you want to continue what's going on with the Shack, including, I guess, maybe a movie now?
Yeah, you know, a movie is definitely a conversation that continues, and I actually have no clue. You're not talking to someone who knows what he's doing, and I like not having an agenda. You know, we don't have any certainty about tomorrow, so we'll just take this a day at a time and see what happens. I love that I have been able to participate in this. You know, Mackenzie, the main character, goes up to the Shack and spends a weekend there. That weekend represents 11 years of my life. And that was a tearing down, rebuilding process. And at the end of those 11 years, everything that matters to me now was in place. So the book was written out of healing, not part of the healing process. And I think that's left me with a tremendous amount of freedom. You know, this experience is not normal. You know, it's just, I didn't see it coming. I'm glad I didn't see it coming. 30 years ago, it would have killed me, you know, because I didn't know who I was. But I know who I am. I know where I've come from. I know that my relationship with Jesus is at the center of everything. And I wouldn't give that up for any of this. If this all went away tomorrow, I'd be absolutely fine. And so the things that matter to me haven't changed. But there are a lot of new challenges, new questions. You know, you get put into a position where we're able to then do things that we weren't able to do before, and we've been able to do some of that, so that's been great fun.
I think the amazing thing is for anybody who allows themselves, if you will, surrenders mm-hmm. to the experience of a relationship with God, that they find that there's just nothing better.
And I think that's true, but it's not an easy process for some of us. You know, like I say, that especially if we've been, like, my sadness includes a very difficult relationship with my father and sexual abuse, not from my family, but outside and at boarding school and things like that. And, you know, we developed skills to keep us safe as children. And those skills become the very thing that then impede our relationship both with God and other people. And it's a hard thing to let go of the very things that kept you alive. So, you know, it's like a relationship with anybody in a sense that it involves mystery, it involves giving, it involves opening, it involves disclosing. And, you know, some of us just aren't good at that for a while, and it just takes some time. But I really believe there is a God who is good all the time, this God who is a relational being, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, who have been in relationship forever, included me in that, and then climbed inside my mess to help heal me, which is a arduous process for some of us, you know. And you know, I'm grateful for every bit of it. I look back and would never want to go through what I've gone through, but I'm grateful for every piece of it.
And God had a plan.
Yeah, you know, and I think his plan is to love us into healing. And I don't think he heals us because he wants to use us. I think he heals us because he loves us, and then he invites us to play.
I had a feeling when this interview started and when I heard you speak here at Capital Christian Center this morning that this is a conversation that needs to go on, and I hope I can come up to Oregon sometime and we can continue it.
That sounds like a great idea. I'd love that.
Thanks so much, Paul, for being with us, and bless you for the book and for you going around and telling people about it and opening up their minds and hearts.
Just a mixture of grace and desperation.
Write me and tell me what you think. You can also write William Paul Young, and I'll forward your emails to him. Here's the Shack author, William Paul Young, at Capital Christian Center in Sacramento.
How could it be his fault? Because, you know, a 6-year-old, a 5-year-old, they believe this is all their fault. But and part of the trouble with sexual abuse, in part, is that it devastates your boundaries, but some of it feels good. So you feel guilty because it felt good. Does that make sense? It's just compounded. And do you want anybody to know about that? Well, I went to boarding school, and it was a shock to begin with, because, you know, I'm thinking I'm black, and I'm finding out I'm white. And I didn't think I was one of those ghost people, mungots, you know, ghost people. And now I don't fit anywhere. I don't fit in this culture, and I don't fit anymore back in the tribal culture. My parents didn't have a clue. You know, my mom was busy and my dad was busy, and I wanted to stay out of my dad's way. And right before I'm 10 years old, we get yanked out of the middle of a school year, dropped into the central part of Canada, and nobody tells us why. And I didn't know until I was 38 years old why we got yanked out of New Guinea. And all of a sudden, there's no communication with us. We're cut off. And my dad begins to preach at different churches. Itinerant preacher, went to 12 schools. Before I graduated, 13 schools before I graduated high school. Moving. Kids develop protective systems, right? Which become the systems that you employ in your relationships as adults. And they don't work as adults. They kept you safe as a child, but they don't work as adults. You know, one of them is hypervigilance, where you've got radar going out all the time in order to stay safe. And you can hear conversations where your name shows up and you can make sure that you go over there to make sure that you're still safe. Spin the story, lie. You do this house on the inside is full of lies. No, you learn how to turn a conversation back on someone. If they see what I did is I built this little facade, this 1/4-inch piece of plywood outside the shack, right? And what I want is for people to believe that that's really me. So I painted as fast as I can pick up your expectations. And then these people over here, I paint it differently because they have different expectations. And so I am a different person in different situations, but I am never myself because I hate myself. I hate what's in the shack. And I think God and everybody else, God hates it anyway. And I'm trying. I mean, I'm really trying using self-discipline or whatever other, you know, works of the flesh that I can figure out might work to try to keep this stuff repressed, you know. And I'm hoping that this 1/4-inch piece of plywood would one day become a real boy. You know, that somehow the shack would just disappear somewhere. And it is a 1/4-inch layer of perfectionist performance. And people constantly poked holes down through it because, you know, I couldn't maintain perfection. I didn't know everything. And when somebody poked a hole, it's what I talked about in the one of the services this morning where I said, you'll learn that shame destroys your ability to distinguish between a value statement and an observation. You know, if somebody makes an observation that you're not perfect, you know, like you colored outside the lines, all you hear is what a worthless human being you are. You don't hear that it was just an observation that you colored outside the lines. You know, later when I was married, Kim would say, don't mix the colors with the whites, talking about laundry. And I heard her say, I don't know why I married such a loser of a human being as you, right? Because shame destroys your ability to distinguish between a value statement and an observation. Because you have a thin layer of perfectionist performance, and when somebody pokes a hole down through that, up comes the shame. And you turn it back on them, you make it their fault. You know, or you freeze up, or you... I'm a religious kid, so I never ran away from anything. I just heard God call me somewhere else.
You can read much more on Paul Young's website, windrumors.com. And, of course, The Shack is available in stores everywhere and online at Barnes & Noble and Amazon. And, in fact, Paul and I are getting together again in Oregon this spring.
This is Don Fass. Join us next weekend and keep reaching up.
And be sure to tell us where you're listening. Write me at reachingupradio@gmail.com. reachingupradio@gmail.
This is the Celebrate Radio Network.
Celebrate Radio Network.
From Montreal to Rio. New York to Moscow.